Okay, this is the unfunny, uncharming part of the program tonight. So, this takes a little while, so anyone who feels they're not quite up to it, it's a good time to go to the bathroom or, excuse me, try to get this out. I'm just giving you fair warning so you have no reason to complain later. But this is going to take a few minutes. And we did this the opening night of the lift. Unfortunately, at that time, I was not able to get Tape Ministry to hook me up to sound, but we are rolling now, and this will be in the archives here for whoever cares. And this is a play I wrote 3 years ago. It's a dramatic monologue. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what the set looked like and what I looked like when I performed this so that you can kind of visualize it. The play is set in a hotel room in Rome, Italy. Speaking of Rome, Italy, not at the Colosseum. The time is sometime in the near future. It's a first-class hotel room. There's so all the things that you would find in a hotel room, including a table at center stage. On the table is a tape recorder, a tape, a pistol, two clips of bullets, tools to clean the pistol with, an ashtray, cigarettes, a lighter. And the character, name of Brooks Thomas, is dressed in a suit and a white shirt with rolled up sleeves. He wears a shoulder holster. And he does a lot of smoking. I'm going to tell you just a little bit about the stage action. During this, he's making a tape. He adjusts the tape levels. He carries the tape recorder with him. He smokes. He walks to the window. He cleans his pistol. He loads his pistol. And that's all the stage directions I'm going to do until the very end when we conclude it. So you have to use your imagination as to how that might play out. This is called The Black Glove. Sarah, this is Dad. Dad, maybe that's not the right word, not in this case. I bet by now you've been calling someone else Dad. Probably the last thing you care to remember is that your real father is me. Sarah, this is your father. If this works, and you're really hearing this tape, you're 18 years old, the age of maturity and independence, and I've been dead for 12 years. By the way, don't try to find out who gave you the tape. It would be more dangerous than you can imagine. I probably shouldn't be doing this, but I know what they're going to do. I know how they think. And I know that you're going to grow up with the wrong idea about me. You're going to think, you do think, that I'm a traitor or a mental case. And I don't know what's worse, putting you in danger 12 years from now to tell you the truth, or leaving you with that awful legacy. Well, there's this consolation. I'll never know how it comes out. I don't know what the official story will be, so first this. I work for the CIA. Yes, the Central Intelligence Agency. A misnomer if there ever was one. Every now and then when something would get botched, some of us would call it cretins, idiots, and assholes. But mostly, we just called it the company. I should say I worked for the company, past tense, because today a lot has changed. Today is why you've probably spent 12 years trying to live everything down. They're probably talking about me like those guys in the old British spy scandals, Kim Philby and that bunch. But they might do it differently than that. They're clever people, oh yes. They might say that I was a broken-down alcoholic who couldn't keep his cloaks and daggers straight anymore. Well, I'm in pain. Who isn't? Maybe I drink too much. But I'm still disciplined when I have to be, at least when my life's on the line. I know what I'm doing, better than ever. And Sarah, I don't know how to talk to you. I don't know who you're going to be. But I want you to know that for once, I'm trying to do the right thing. Looking back, I can't get figure out how I got started in this sordid business. It started in college. It's where I met Jackie, your mom. She liked my cynical humor. I was a philosophy major, can you believe that? You know, philosophy, the art of deconstructing life to the point where even the mundane and monotonous becomes angst-ridden beyond endurance. A little Hegel and Nietzsche, and I was set for the day with a really foul mood. Well, never mind, it's too late to second-guess everything in my life. Anyway, this friend of mine wanted to see the CIA recruiter. He took me along for moral support, if that's the right expression. I just wanted to exercise my progressive wit. But I ended up talking to the guy for a long time. He was a sharp character. He had liberals for breakfast. He told me about how my fine ideas about civilization meant nothing in South Yemen or Angola or Iran. He said that if I was brave, if I really loved truth, I would go see for myself what the world was like. Well, the timing was right for that kind of challenge. I had no career lined up. I was just drifting through academia. My parents were social workers in Brooklyn, which was fine. I admired that. But that was too much of a microcosm for me. I wanted the world. I wanted to figure out the big secret, whatever it was. I wanted life with its arm twisted behind its back, ready to do my bidding. Jackie wasn't happy. It scrapped a lot of plans, I guess. And her view of the CIA was, not charitable. But she went along because she loved me. Then. I was cruel to her, Sarah. See, I didn't really have any values. I mouthed awful about a lot of things, but I just like to hear myself talk. And when you're like that, when you have no foundation, you don't know how to deal with the hurt, the pain of living. You don't know, I didn't know, what value I had. So I decided I was going to prove my value by testing Jackie's loyalty. There were times I even encouraged her to leave me. I was relieved when she didn't. I saw other women and then promised to do better, but I never felt secure. She probably hasn't told you about those years in Spain. With all the ugliness that came after, I guess that time isn't real to her anymore. But it was beautiful for a while. I was the assistant to the CIA bureau chief there. Jackie and I used to go up in the mountains outside of Granada. We'd take a bottle of wine, some bread. There were small lakes up there from the snow melting. We competed to see who could stay in the water longest. She made it once for 30 seconds, I think. And I used to read to her a lot of different things, but often some Edgar Allan Poe. The poems, mostly. El Dorado, Lenore, Annabelle Lee. Neither the angels in heaven above nor the demons down under the sea could ever dissever my soul from the soul of the beautiful Annabelle Lee. She loved the sound of my voice, which was funny because she had the loveliest voice I'd ever heard. It was like a Bach harpsichord concerto, and she wasn't even aware of it. We think you were conceived in one of those trips to the mountains. But by the time you were born, we were already in Rome, and the good days were over. I found Italian harder than Spanish, and the Red Brigade more fearsome than those ragtag fascists in Madrid. Most of all, I found that being bureau chief was much harder than sitting behind a desk analyzing intelligence. All my life, I had evaded responsibility. Well, here in Rome, it caught up with me, big time. The first 6 months, we were scraping bodies off the sidewalk like burnt pizza. People talk about Islamic militants, but the Red Brigade was the craziest bunch I've ever come across. For them, to kill was to be. Well, Sarah, I hit the vino pretty good about then. I guess I found I did have one value. I was sickened by senseless slaughter. I started getting a little crazy. Jackie didn't know what to do. On my good days, I was a trial. And now there weren't any more good days. I was used to her patience and her forgiving smile. But I cursed her when she left. But I can't blame her anymore. Except for Spain, it had all been bad. I don't know how much you know about those 6 months after your mom left. It was the middle of the school year. Jackie had to find a new life in the States anyway. I realized I had never paid much attention to you. And suddenly there was this trusting, dark-eyed kid looking up at me like, what next? You were 5 then. I still was pretty detached. I got someone to look after you. I didn't have much choice about that. But I spent more time at home than when your mom was there. As the spy world came to make less and less sense to me, you came to represent what was real. Despite all the troubles, I loved Italy. I wanted to show it all to you, but I felt rushed. You probably couldn't understand much. I remember you on my shoulders in the Sistine Chapel. I tried to get you to look up at Michelangelo's ceiling, but you just played with my tie. I had this feeling of there's not enough time. Finally, the inevitable happened. Jackie sent for you, so I had to let you go. I had Uncle Bob take you to the airport. Remember Uncle Bob? He wasn't your uncle, just a friend from the company. I can say that now. He's dead. I couldn't go to the airport. I just couldn't. I wonder, do you hate me for that? Well, Sarah, I'm sorry. About that time, things really started to go to hell. See, Italy was just a sieve for terrorists. The government was always calling new elections, and there was a new prime minister every 6 months. The security forces were incompetent from top to bottom. Some of the nastiest people in the world just came and went. They might as well have put a shingle out. Our job was to keep tabs on the traffic. We would also help the Italian government whenever we could do it without getting ourselves implicated. Everything had to be real discreet, or we'd have more American tourists getting blown up in airport lounges. Back in the States, I guess, I started to get a reputation. I became known inside the company as someone with discretion who picked his targets well and provided good raw intelligence and analysis. The DCI, the director, even had me in his office once in Langley, Virginia. He just wanted to tell me that I was doing a hell of a good job, that he had mentioned me at several of the president's daily intelligence briefings. I was getting better at my work, no doubt about that, because I wanted to be involved. I didn't want to think. When I read transcripts of tapped phone calls or decoded radio transmissions, I wasn't thinking about Jackie or about you, sir. It wasn't love of country that drove me on, although maybe there was some subliminal faith that whatever we did, we weren't as out to lunch as most of the world. There were more women. I guess I never really stopped with that. I liked the hot olive look in the Mediterranean. I knew I was just medicating myself, but I couldn't stop. I didn't see anything else for comfort. I didn't realize what was going on after Jackie left, but I was getting desperate. I looked everywhere and found no meaning. When I thought I started to see some through you, you left too. I was headed for a fall. And now a funny thing has happened. The CIA has put some meaning in my life. There have been rumors in the company about some operatives we've been using. People without a country or a movement or an ideology. Men and some women who sold their services to whoever would pay. Disinformation, theft, arson, assassination, especially assassination. It's hard to say, but there were once probably about 20 of these operatives. No one admitted using them, but that was the point. Complete deniability if they were caught or killed. These assassins are given their orders through middlemen, and the middlemen are killed as a security precaution. Even if one of the assassins wanted to confess, he could only guess at which country hired him. And everyone has used them. The CIA, the former KGB, Israel's Mossad, and on and on. There's an unwritten agreement that these people are not to be put on trial or killed. It's shocking, and it isn't. After all, we used Nazis for intelligence operations right after World War II. The Mafia was hired to kill Castro. We've sold arms to some of the most bloodthirsty people on this continent. A moral foreign policy is a fiction for the flag wavers back home. This world has always been about self-interest. Anyway, everybody had heard these rumors about the international assassins. This morning, I found out it's true. The DCI flew into Rome on a day's notice. He brought the National Security Advisor with him, a real asshole. They told me to clear my calendar. It was hot. And when they got here, I learned I was being admitted into an elite circle. that only a handful of other Americans knew what I was about to be told, and that the president, for political reasons, was not among them. And that's when I finally heard about the black glove. You see, of those 20 or so operatives, one stands out. He's not only without a country or a political group, he's also without a face or a name. He first contacted one of our agents in Madagascar about 15 years ago. He left a note in the agent's hotel room saying he was for hire. He knew enough about our setup to clue us in that we had some loose lips inside the company. The bureau chief in Madagascar figured it would be dangerous to let the note go unanswered, so he responded in vague terms, implying that we wanted a certain Secret Service goon bumped off in an African country that wasn't named, but that could be figured out with a little intuition. And this note was also left in our agent's hotel room, as per instructions. Well, sure enough, 2 days later, the thug in question turned up dead in his bathtub with a bullet placed cleanly between his eyes. A black left-hand glove was laid across his head. The DCI got a letter in Langley postmarked the day of the assassination. It was a bill for $500,000, along with an elaborate set of instructions on how to deliver the money. The price was outrageous, considering the insignificance of the victim. But the DCI was intrigued by the assassin's competence and brazenness. He took to calling him the Black Glove, and the name stuck. Nobody ever learned his identity or background. Now, the DCI and this assassin apparently worked out some convoluted way in which the CIA would let him know when we needed his services again. Before long, the Black Glove entrepreneur that he is had freelance work from a dozen countries. The trademark Black Glove is always left with the corpse. I was shocked on two counts. First, I wouldn't have believed such a thing could be hidden from me. And then I was revolted by the policy itself. Yes, the victims were just as dead as if we had used our own agents, but to align ourselves with an unknown assassin who killed for profit only, I couldn't stomach that. Then the DCI handed me a file, Brooks Thomas, eyes only. It was a whole new security clearance, which I suppose should have been an honor. But then I found out that the reason I was being let in on this secret was more repugnant than the secret itself. You see, Sarah, within the next hour, the Black Glove is supposed to kill the British Foreign Secretary. The British Foreign Secretary. I don't know what this sounds like to you 12 years from now. I don't know if what happens in the next 60 minutes will ever get into the papers or the history books. But I swear to you, Sarah, this is the truth as I know it in the final minutes of my life. You see, the British and Americans are going different ways. Back in the 80s, the British were the staunchest U.S. allies. They let us launch our bombing raid on Libya from their soil. When we needed moral support for our tough stand against the Soviets, they gave it to us. But then the conservative British government collapsed. The Labour Party, back in power for a year now, wants to pull out of NATO. That's the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Hopefully you've read about it, because it might not exist in 12 years. NATO kept the balance of power in Europe. But with the breakup of the Soviet Empire, the British Labourites said they didn't need to put scarce money into the military alliance anymore. In the inner circles in Washington, there's panic. They think England is weak, just like before World War II, inviting aggression. We know that when it comes to foreign policy, the force behind the British Prime Minister is his foreign secretary, who was once a socialist. The DCI says if the foreign secretary is out of the picture, the prime minister won't have the nerve to pull out of NATO. And therefore, the DCI has hired the Black Glove to kill the foreign secretary. It's all coming down now. The foreign secretary is chairing a conference in Rome tonight. I've been instructed to create diversions for the local police as he enters the hotel, presumably to allow an assassination in the lobby. I'm also to create some security loopholes at the airport so that the Black Glove can escape. I don't know the other details, and I still don't know who this man is. The DCI gave an incredible speech. Look, Brooks, this is a distasteful business, but you know, we wouldn't involve you if it wasn't absolutely necessary. Now, you've been in the company for 8 years now, but that's not really a long time. After a while, you see, it's the long term, the big picture that counts. We don't like killing a cabinet minister from a friendly country, but damn it, man, it has to be done. The whole balance of power in the world is at stake. You'll be a hero to your country, to the New World Order, and to the cause of freedom down through history. Right. I nodded at the right times. With the DCI and the National Security Advisors standing there, I set the wheels in motion. I signed the orders in front of them and assured them that I would be at the scene to personally oversee the operation. But I secretly detested the whole business. So now I have come to the moment that my whole life has been leading up to. Sarah, the world only seems random, but there is a destiny that we can choose or refuse. It comes from God. It might mean being poor and never amounting to much, but just being simple and honest. Or another person might be rich, but magnanimous. Or someone else, in an instant, might have to draw upon a reservoir of strength they didn't know they had. But sooner or later, there's that fork in the road. I'm in the hotel where the British Foreign Secretary is due to arrive soon. In a minute, when I finish speaking to you across the years, I'm going down to the lobby. It's funny the way things have turned out, but I'm a good spy. I can tell many things about a person from a quick glance. I can usually smell one of my own. But the black glove is the best. It's been 15 years since that day in Madagascar, and no one knows who he is or where he came from. He's never blown an assignment, never let his prey escape. So what it comes down to is an educated guess, no time to analyze. When I move through that crowd in the lobby and I think I've spotted him, or her, I'll have a second, maybe two. Any longer, and the Foreign Secretary will be dead. And Sarah, my dear, I will be dead either way. One of my own men will shoot me if the black glove does it. And to cover up the operation, they'll have to make up a story. And that's why, for the next 12 years, if you know about me at all, you're going to know me as a traitor to his country, a man who mysteriously tried to kill the British Foreign Secretary. They'll bring up the booze, the women. They'll say I was unstable, an easy target for blackmail. And on and on. What you are listening to, my daughter, is a very dangerous piece of tape. I have made arrangements for it to be placed in a bank deposit box. I won't even tell you the country. A series of payoffs over the years should result in the tape being given to you. No person who is a link in that chain will know what the purpose is or what any of the other links have done. So I think you're safe. But just the same, once you've heard this tape, destroy it. Sarah, your old man isn't a traitor. I have been a fool. I failed or mistreated everyone who has ever loved me. I accept that. My hope is that all that suffering is for a reason. I hope that I'm doing the right thing. Then maybe, just maybe, the pain will have been worth it. And I hope you will one day know that your father finally did stand up for something. And that I loved your mom very much. Brooks Thomas hits the stop button. He ejects the tape. He takes an envelope out of his pocket, puts the tape in the envelope and seals it. He takes a roll of tape out of another pocket and tapes the envelope underneath the table. Several sirens are heard. He loads the clip in the gun, puts the gun in his shoulder holster, puts on his suit coat. He goes to the window. After a moment, he pads the gun in the shoulder holster, takes a deep breath, buttons his coat, and exits. Thank you. Tara and Heather.